from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Oval Office speeches are usually reserved for unifying moments or major presidential proclamations. Last night, President Trump used his first televised Oval speech to deliver a fear-based plea for his border wall.
The federal government remains shut down for one reason and one reason only, because Democrats will not fund border security.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi responded.
President Trump must stop holding the American people hostage, must stop manufacturing a crisis, and must reopen the government.
Now on day 19 of the government shutdown, the president and Democrats are no closer to reopening the government and no closer to agreeing on the realities at the southern border. This hour on Point, analyzing the president's border security address from the Oval Office. And you can join us. What did you hear in President Trump's speech last night? What about the Democratic response from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senator Chuck Schumer? How can the government move forward now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us today first from Washington is Eliana Johnson. She's White House reporter for Politico. We've got a link to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Eliana, it's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Also with us today from New York is Julian Zelizer. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and author of many books on the presidency and American history, including Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. That was just released yesterday. Julian Zelizer, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Eliana, let me start with you first of all. We'll dig more into the speech in a second here, but what's going on in the White House and on Capitol Hill today? Where is the president? Is he continuing to try to advocate for the wall?
He is. Today is a big day for the president, who's having a breakneck series of meetings with lawmakers to try to get them to try to make the case for a national emergency. He's having lunch with Senate Republicans at their weekly policy lunch. He and Vice President Mike Pence will join for that, and then meeting with Democratic leaders at the White House at 3 p.m. Two really key meetings. And I think after that, we'll have a much greater sense of where things will go. Inside the White House, there's a debate over whether it makes sense for the president to declare a national emergency in order to get this wall built and whether that's the best way for the president to get out of this shutdown, which is now in the middle of its third week, one of the longest in American history.
So the possibility of declaring a national emergency still very much on the table?
Absolutely. I think some people were surprised the president didn't do it last night. But the debate in the White House really wasn't over whether it would happen last night, but whether it will happen going forward and what the right time would be if they decide to do so, to declare it, and then what the appropriate venue would be. President's lawyers very much studying the legality of this, preparing for a legal challenge if he does it, and figuring out the best way to defend this in the courts.
Okay. So this is really interesting because as far as I can tell, and, you know, who knows in the first 24 hours of a speech like this, but it doesn't seem to have moved the needle at all. But it was interesting, like you've reported and other folks, White House reporters, reported last night that the president didn't even want to give this speech necessarily. He doesn't necessarily want to go to his planned trip to the border tomorrow. So how did we end up with what we saw on television last night?
It's a great question. You know, this is part of a legal strategy as much as a public relations strategy. If the president does, in fact, declare a national emergency, his lawyers have to have things to point to in legal briefs to say there really is a national emergency here. That's why you've heard the president and the vice president change their rhetoric. All of a sudden, they're talking about a humanitarian crisis on the border, national security risks, and the president's Oval Office address, his visit to the border, meetings with lawmakers, interestingly, took place in the White House Situation Rooms. Those are all things that the president's lawyers would point to in legal briefs to say there really is a national emergency involving the nation's national security on the U.S.-Mexico border. The president likes to talk about illegal immigrant crime more than anything else. Humanitarian crises are really not his bailiwick.
Yeah.
And so So I think that's why he's been reluctant to do these things. And you saw him, I think, reading off a script. He's much more subdued than when he wings it, in rallies.
Okay. Well, Julian Zelizer, let me turn to you here, because you've written that you think the president's address last night amounts to presidential malpractice. Why is that?
Look, this has been an entirely manufactured crisis. There is absolutely no evidence confirming the problems that the president is highlighting, other than the humanitarian crisis that the president and the administration themselves, family separation, have been responsible for. So what we're seeing is a president first basically trying to legislate by holding the government hostage until he gets the funding for something new that he wants. And then to sell this, as we're now hearing, creating a crisis that doesn't exist and standing firm until Democrats concede. So this is not really effective, and many would say it's not really a moral way for the president to govern.
So situate this speech then in historical context for us. I mean, how does it compare to other Oval Office addresses that presidents have given?
Well, presidents have used these Oval Office addresses for all sorts of reasons. Many presidents have used it to promote or try to convince the public of a certain policy. President Carter did this with energy conservation. President Reagan did this with tax cuts. Presidents often use this in times of military crisis or when troops are going to be deployed. George W. Bush, for example, did this after 9/11. And so using the address is not novel, and using the address to promote something is not novel either. I think what many commentators are struck by was the total disconnect between the situation he says exists on the border, whether you're talking about alleged narcotics inflow from the border to overwhelming number of people trying to flow in, and the reality on the ground. That's what makes this different, the scale and scope of the disinformation from what we've seen before.
Well, I mean, so to put it bluntly, the things that he said that weren't true in virtually every paragraph of the speech.
Absolutely. Almost all of it. And again, the context in which he is holding the government or closing the government until he gets something new that he hasn't been able to persuade Congress to give him. Even in 96, you know, the Republicans were trying to cut the funding or reduce the funding for a program that was already in existence, Medicare. In 2013, the debate was a president trying to protect a program Congress had created, ACA. Here, the president's actually trying to legislate through this. And so it's not only everything that was false and everything that was wrong in the speech itself, but it's what he's actually trying to do. Mm. He's totally going around the legislative process, even as he's putting pressure on Congress.
Well, since you mentioned the part of the speech where he talked about drugs crossing the southern border here, let's listen to that. Here's the president last night from the Oval Office talking about drug trafficking as one of the reasons why he wants that border wall.
Our southern border is a pipeline for vast quantities of illegal drugs, including meth, heroin, cocaine, and fentanyl. Every week, 300 of our citizens are killed by heroin alone, 90% of which floods across from our southern border. More Americans will die from drugs this year than were killed in the entire Vietnam War.
Now, some fact-checking around this. First of all, according to the National Archives, more than 58,000 Americans were killed in the Vietnam War. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say that more than 70,000 drug overdose deaths occurred in the United States in 2017. So strictly speaking, by the numbers, yes, more than in the Vietnam War. But it's not clear from the CDC numbers how many of those drug overdose deaths were due to heroin that crossed from the southern border. Now, about the president's claim that 90% of the heroin floods across the southern border, that part is true. The majority of heroin coming into the country is coming in over the Mexico border. However, it's not flooding in across the unsecured parts of the border. The vast majority of it, according to Customs and Border Protection and the DEA, come in through ports of entry on, for example, tractor trailers that contain both legal goods and hidden drugs as well. So ports of entry being the weakness there, and a wall wouldn't make any bit of difference. So Eliana Johnson here, I mean, that's just one example of sort of the fact-challenged nature of this speech. I mean, what was your reaction to that?
There are a couple things. You know, the White House pushes back on that and they say, well, we're asking for more manpower at these ports of entry. But I think overall, we didn't hear from the president what's different, how the situation on the border is different right now as opposed to a year ago or 2 years ago. What's the emergency today, tomorrow, that and why is he? But if he is going to declare a national emergency, what's the emergency now? How have conditions changed? You know, and why do we need this wall? Or why are we granting the executive branch these sweeping powers? Right, the temporal case, I think, was missing from the president's address.
Right. And, you know, in fact, on the flip side of that, I know many of the president's supporters look to Democrats and say, you haven't given us a convincing reason other than your principle that you say about why a wall wouldn't work. Isn't that right?
Right. They say that Democrats used to favor building a wall and now they don't. You know, the president made that point in his address last night. But I think Congress does have the power of the purse. And you've even heard some of the president's allies on Fox News say the president has very little negotiating power right now. And I think that's why you're trying to see him find a way out of this by other means. I think it's fair to say there's broad understanding in the White House that Congress is not going to give him a penny to build this wall.
All right. Well, that's Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico. Eliana, stand by. Julian Zelizer is also with us. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And we're analyzing the president's speech last night. We'll hear more about the Democratic response when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the president's Oval Office address last night about border security, the Democratic response as well. We didn't actually hear all that new or much new at all last night. So what does it mean and how can the government move forward from this point? We're joined today by Eliana Johnson. She's White House reporter for Politico. Julian Zelizer is also with us. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And Julian, let me just ask you a quick question here. I mean, you've written a lot about polarization in America. And again, your latest book, Fault Lines, takes a close look at this since the mid-70s. In a way, we kind of saw those fault lines in sharp, sharp relief last night. It was once again an example of how we have almost parallel universes in both in Washington and reflected in the United States. I mean, I don't want to just say how significant is it, but do you see any way of moving forward from this?
I think I'd start by saying you're right in that the two parties see this issue in fundamentally different terms. And so it's not really, even when the president speaks, an effort to communicate to the other side. It's just one side versus the other. And what's striking about the president is he plays directly to these fault lines. He is not making a speech to convince anyone other than those who are already convinced. His purpose is to shore up his support, to make sure that Republicans don't start to buckle under political pressure. And I think that's really, there's two ways out of this, it seems to me, that are realistic. One is that he takes up this strategy of saying, fine, I'll open the government, and now I declare that I'm going to use emergency powers to get the money I want. And then that's fought out in another arena, both in the courts and maybe Congress. And two is that this partisanship starts to work against the president, meaning Republicans in Congress start to realize that their partisan interest is not in supporting the president. And they can vote to reopen government with numbers that would be able to override a veto. So they have a lot of power if they wanted to use it. And so I think that's how partisanship affects what we saw last night and the discussion today. And I think those are the two ways it might impact the resolution.
So, Eliana Johnson, pick up on that. I mean, you just recently wrote a story for Politico that whose headline was Trump wages intense but lonely campaign for his border wall. I mean, who are the Republicans who are falling away?
A couple things make the shutdown unique, I think. The first is that it's a partial shutdown. And so not to minimize the people affected by it who are obviously suffering, but I think nationally people aren't quite feeling it as much. But the second thing is that on both sides, the president's Republican base supports the president, and the Democratic base supports Democratic leaders who have taken a moral stand against this wall. So the bases of both parties are behind the leaders. And we didn't hear anything new last night, but it's as if both the president and Democrats have been saying the same things to each other for 3 weeks, and we haven't made any progress. The Republicans we see falling away from the president are more moderate Republicans who are up for re-election in 2020 and worried that this is going to have a political cost. So we saw Colorado Senator Cory Gardner, who interestingly ran the National Republican Senatorial Committee this last election cycle and saw moderate Republicans in suburban areas lose. I think he's worried that this is something that could affect him. Susan Collins of Maine, who's always a moderate voice in the party. So I think the White House worried that those people could start to split off and the president could lose support from his party. But again, the bases of both parties very firmly behind their leaders. And I think that's partly why we have seen very little progress thus far.
Well, so let's listen to another Republican then here. This is Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski. She told reporters last night that she thinks Congress should open the government or reopen government agencies before resolving the fight over the border wall.
The operations of the Department of the Interior and the National Park Service, or the operations of the IRS and whether or not tax refunds go out, don't have anything to do with border security. So let's bifurcate these issues. Let's set them aside. Let's allow for the operations, these governmental functions in these six other departments, allow for them to continue.
So that's Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski saying set aside the border wall because it doesn't really have anything to do with the operations of government agencies like the IRS. On the other hand, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham had a completely different message for his Republican colleagues on an interview with Fox News last night.
This is the best chance we'll ever have to help President Trump get border wall funding, steel barrier funding, and at the same time fix the loopholes. The only way we lose is to give in. If we'll stand firm, put deals on the table that make sense, we will win this on behalf of the American people. But if we undercut the president, that's the end of his presidency and the end of our party, and we deserve to be punished if we give in now.
That's South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. Julian Zelizer, that last part of what Graham said, that if Republicans undercut the president, it's the end of the presidency and the end of the party. Does Graham have a point? I mean, for a while now, many folks that I've talked to, like you, have said the GOP has become the party of Trump. Is Graham right?
Oh, absolutely. I think Graham is being very blunt and very honest, and he has been one of the most partisan figures in the last few years, doing almost anything the president needs. And the president's support, although people love to talk about the base, really is the Republican Party more broadly. And what the president has depended on is that partisanship. It's the fact Republicans will tolerate President Trump over a Democrat. And that means they've protected him on many fronts, whether you're talking about the investigation or whether you're talking about his flexing executive and presidential power. If Republicans started to peel away, that would be a big problem because all of a sudden the Senate would look a lot more threatening to the White House, whereas right now it's still pretty much a bastion of safety. The second part, I think, is more suspect. Would this destroy the Republican Party? There's a counterargument, and that's what you're hearing from Murkowski a little bit, that the Republicans actually need to save themselves. And it's at some point, the question is, do they ever see the way to do that is actually to separate from a president who is undertaking some destructive measures?
Well, let's get a couple of calls in here while I can. Anne is calling from Bar Harbor, Maine. Anne, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. So I am a retired federal employee, so I have been through several shutdowns, and it's really hard. But I would like to step back from that and back from partisanship and just say, in general, paying ransom and appeasing bullies is really bad policy because it rewards bad actors and invites them to get worse. And so a politics of emotionalism and anecdote is bad enough, but trying to govern on emotionalism and anecdote totally unhinged from fact is even worse. And I think we can look at our invasion of Iraq under Bush and Cheney as what to expect if we keep going down this path.
Right. Well, Anne, your phone's getting a little tough to understand there, but I thank you so very much for your call. That's Anne calling from Bar Harbor, Maine. Let's go to Troy, who's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Troy, you're on the air.
Yes, I think President Trump did a wonderful job explaining his agenda of keeping us safe from illegals coming across the border. I think the Democrats, you know, don't believe in, you know, the wall will work. What is their proposal? Automatic machine gun sensing motion and landmines? What exactly are they thinking is going to be working?
Well, Troy, thank you for your call. And actually, I'm going to get an answer to it from a Democratic senator. So let's turn to Senator Chris Van Hollen. He's a Democrat from Maryland, and he joins us today from Washington. Senator Van Hollen, welcome to On Point.
Magna, great to be with you.
So you just heard our caller, Troy, there, calling from Iowa City, saying that he thought the president made his case very well last night. And what he didn't hear was an effective counter response from the Democrats. He's saying, what is the Democratic proposal instead of a wall? What would you tell Troy?
Well, the dispute has never been about the need for effective border security. We need effective border security. While the government's being shut down now, you've got the folks who are providing that security, both along the border as well as at airports, the folks at TSA, who are having to go to work without any pay. So what we've proposed is let's not hold the country hostage to this debate and this dispute as to the most effective way to provide border security. Certainly, let's reopen the 8 of the 9 federal departments that have nothing to do with border security, and then we can figure out the best way to go about this. But shutting down the government, denying services to millions of Americans and an increasing number every day, and requiring 800,000 people to go without pay, some working without pay, is not the right way to deal with this. There are funds in the legislation supported by Democrats to fund border security in an effective way. That already includes, I should indicate, barriers along certain parts of the border that were built before President Trump became president. It also includes, obviously, border security personnel as well as technology. The president mentioned last night some of the drugs coming across the southern border. The way to deal with that is to increase screening at ports of entry, which is where the drugs are coming from. Building a 2,000-mile wall is not going to stop that because it's smuggled through places where people come through normal ports of entry. So these are some common sense things, but for goodness sakes, stop holding the country hostage. We should have that debate, but we shouldn't be denying services and throwing 800,000 people out of work without paychecks.
Senator Van Hollen, let me ask you, just a couple of minutes ago, we played a little bit of tape from Senator Murkowski, who was, you know, saying sort of similar things, like she wants to decouple the debate over the wall from the functioning of the United States federal government. So, I mean, is there... Are we starting to see the glimmer of possibilities, at least on the Senate side here, or not, for as long as, on the other hand, for as long as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has been resolute in saying that he's not going to bring anything to the floor if the president isn't going to support it?
Well, I was heartened by the comments made by Senator Murkowski. There are a number of other senators, Republican senators now, who have taken the same position. And last night here in the Senate, Senate Democrats united to send a strong signal that the first order of business has to be reopening the government, and that we have the keys to reopening the government right here in the Senate, because the House of Representatives, as their first order of business, passed two bills. One was virtually identical to what the Senate passed just before Christmas, that reopening the Department of Homeland Security and keeping it operational till February 8th while we have this debate with the president. The other one would reopen the federal government at funding levels supported by Senate Republicans. So let's vote on that. If the president wants to veto it, that's his decision. But our Senate colleagues should not be complicit and become accomplices in this shutdown that Donald Trump said he would be proud to do.
Right. Well, two more questions, if I may. First of all, Senator, I mean, Eliana Johnson, the White House reporter for Politico, who's been very patiently listening to this, she told us earlier in the hour that the president has not taken the possibility of declaring a national emergency off the table. Now, if he does indeed go down that path and do that and make that declaration, what would you do?
Well, I think as we've looked at the powers of the president, it's increasingly clear that that would be a very legally suspect approach for the president to take. It's pretty clear that he may have a power to somehow declare a national emergency, but it is not at all clear that he has the legal authority to order the military to instruct a 2,000-mile-long wall along the southern border as part of that authority. And as you know, you've got House Republicans on the House Armed Services Committee. The leading House Republican on the House Armed Services Committee has said he's opposed to the president using his emergency authority in that way. It really is an abuse of power. It's a way to try to go around the constitutional processes we have for making decisions. And just because the president doesn't like the result doesn't mean that he can lapse on, you know, try and use this kind of authority in an illegal way.
Okay. And last question, if I can just turn a corner here a little bit with you, because there's lots of news going on today, as there is every day. We're seeing the reports here that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein has said, or is saying, that he will depart the Justice Department when the new Attorney General is confirmed. The White House is saying this is Rosenstein's choice, that the president is not forcing him out. But Senator Van Hollen, I'm just wondering what your reaction to that is, and if you have any concerns about Rod Rosenstein leaving the DOJ.
I do have concerns about Rod Rosenstein leaving. He has been somebody who has preserved the integrity of the Mueller investigation during his period of time overseeing that. Now we have somebody coming in Bill Barr, who is going to have his hearing before the Senate shortly, who essentially auditioned for the job of Attorney General by telling the Justice Department, the president, that he did not think that the Mueller investigation was justified and even questioned its legitimacy. So this is a very dangerous moment, in my view, to the rule of law to see Rod leaving. And as to this being voluntary, I would just remind people that, you know, the president at one time suggested that Rod Rosenstein, among others, should be imprisoned because he was part of this effort to call for a special counsel to do this investigation. So it's hard to believe that if Rod Rosenstein was, you know, pleased with the way things were going and felt that people respected his views, that he'd be leaving. So I think this is a dangerous moment, and it's just another moment in an administration that has unfortunately undermined important institutions like the Department of Justice and the rule of law. And we saw it again last night where the president just had another allergy to the truth. Fact checkers had to work overtime on his 8-minute long speech.
Well, Senator Chris Van Hollen, Democrat from Maryland, speaking to us from Washington. Senator Van Hollen, thank you so very much.
And thank you.
And Eliana Johnson and Julian Zelizer, thank you for being so patient through that. We're going to get your reaction to what the senator said when we come back from a quick break. We are talking about President Trump's Oval Office speech last night and where we are with the government shutdown, whether or not the president still will declare a national emergency. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about President Trump's speech from the Oval Office last night. And Eliana Johnson joins us. She's White House reporter for Politico. Julian Zelizer is also with us. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And Eliana, before the break, we were speaking with Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, their Democrat of Maryland. And I was just wondering sort of what you thought from what you heard the senator say. He was fairly confident in, sort of the Democrats' approach to this impasse. But your reaction to what Senator Van Hollen said.
Yeah, you know, I think it's very clear among Democrats, but also in the White House, that the president is not going to get a penny from Congress for this border wall. And I think that is why you see the president turning to other options like declaring a national emergency, which would allow him to end the shutdown, but also not appear to his political base like he's caving on the central issue of his campaign. The other thing I think we heard from the senator was that Democrats aren't going to like the declaration of a national emergency any more than they like the $5.7 billion demand for money to fund the border wall. And so the president will be turning, I think, if he chooses to do that, from one political tinderbox to another.
And Julian Zelizer, wouldn't the declaration of a national emergency be perhaps an even bigger tinderbox?
It could be. I think some Democrats are putting it aside and saying it will never work. I'm not convinced of that. We've seen presidents use emergency power often and excessively, so we shouldn't underestimate his ability to use it. But yes, there'll be two fires he'll have to put out. One will be in the courts where this will clearly be challenged, that this is not a proper use of this power. And second, Congress under 1976 legislation that allows the president to invoke emergency power also can push back and try to stop him. So I think he'll have two fights on his hand, but President Trump doesn't mind that. I think he is willing to go to the next fight when one isn't working. We've seen this before, such as with the health care debate, and he might reach a point where that's more appealing to him if he thinks this is a no-win situation.
Right. Well, Julian, let me ask you. I mean, is part of the reason why we're gripped in this moment of what feels like political paralysis, Is it because this is one of the outgrowths of the centrality, the political centrality of the presidency to both parties, right? I mean, we have a Republican Party that's almost, it feels as if it's waiting for to see what the president is going to do next. And I think you can make the argument that the presidency has become as central to the Democratic Party as well when a Democrat's in the White House. I mean, is that part of the problem here?
That's absolutely true. We're watching a debate emerge, at least, over presidential power. But in the last, since Richard Nixon, after an effort to restrain the president, I think we're seeing that the president still has a lot of power. And even if Congress remains a roadblock, and even if Congress can still check the president, there are many other avenues that the president can take to shape debate through the bully pulpit, which is now social media in many ways, or through using executive power. And what's unclear is who's going to stop it. And what we see with President Trump is someone who's willing to flex all these powers that do exist pretty liberally and in ways that other recent presidents were not willing to do. And so both parties are reckoning with this institution they created and looking at someone who's willing to go to places with this power that other presidents were not.
Okay. Well, let's go to some calls here. Let's go to Charles, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Charles, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. I find it interesting that when Republicans controlled Congress, they still couldn't get the funding for the wall. But all of a sudden, as soon as the Democrats took control, it's 100% their fault. The second point I'd like to make is that Trump could be creating a national emergency by having this shut down with the TSA and the Coast Guard not being paid. Those folks are going to have to go to a job that's going to give them a paycheck. So they'll call in sick and they'll go to their other job where they can actually make some cash. And unintentional consequences of creating his own national emergency.
Hmm. Charles, thank you for your call. Eliana Johnson, let's take Charles's first point there. I mean, he pointed out that, yes, for 2 years, the GOP controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House and couldn't get a wall funded or didn't put it front and center as much as the president may have liked. I mean, remind us of that, because they did have control of both key branches of government.
That's right. And I think one of the things you're hearing Republicans murmur, you know, under the radar is that the president missed opportunities over the past 2 years to get his wall funded. And he missed opportunities to pick fights over this and perhaps picked a fight at an inopportune time. Others are saying, including some of the president's political advisors, that this is a good fight to pick, that he wants to contrast with Democrats on this issue because his political base loves it, and that, in fact, getting into a shutdown over this issue was exactly the right thing to do, that it will benefit him in the 2020 reelection race. I think the president's growing a little uncomfortable with that argument, but that certainly was what some of his top political advisors were telling him after he had that Oval Office showdown with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, where he said, I'd be proud to shut down the government over border security. You know, others, I think, are rueing the fact that they didn't press harder to get this wall funded when Republicans controlled both chambers.
Right, because when they controlled both chambers, they didn't need a Democratic vote, right, to pass legislation that may have included the wall. I mean, is what we're seeing here now also perhaps in the mind of the president, an unfortunate reality that in the past 2 years, the wall wasn't as important to other Republicans, congressmen and women, that as it was to him. And now he's putting it once again front and center, but he's in a much more difficult situation with divided government.
Right. This is never going to happen for him now. And so you've seen him look at alternatives. You heard him say that he is pressing other government agencies to look in their budgets, a sort of scrounge in the couch cushion strategy. And then at the national emergency, you also saw him talk about trading DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, legalizing undocumented children who came here as people who came here as minors who may now be adults, but legalizing them, trading that, which is a Democratic priority and a priority for some Republicans, for wall funding, which would be an enormous thing to trade. Really never going to happen during a shutdown. But you've seen the president put that on the table, really looking at an array of alternatives to get himself out of the situation and to get that wall funded.
Yeah. Well, let me get two last calls in here. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Cheyenne, Wyoming. Steve, you're on the air.
I just wanted to say a few things about the Democrat senator or congressman, whoever he was.
Senator Van Hollen, yeah.
Drugs coming across. They come into the ports. They don't come into the port of entries. If they were, they would be stupid. Illegal immigrants.
Steve, let me just jump in here for a second. I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I want to just be sure we have the facts straight. Senator Van Hollen was talking about the actual heroin that does, even the Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection. He was talking about the actual heroin that comes in through the ports of entries. That's the government itself says that.
Yeah, but the majority of the drugs don't come through the ports. They're criminals that are breaking the laws by bringing drugs into this country that are killing millions of people.
But just to underscore, that is not what the government itself says. The government.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, but do you have a source for that?
We need a wall. Do I have a what for it?
I mean, if you're contradicting what the Department of Homeland Security is saying about where the drugs are coming through the border, do you have a source for that information?
Well, the news that I listen to, and you know how good that is. All I know is that illegal drug dealers that are coming down into this country from the south do not travel through the port of entries. And who in their right mind would think that a drug dealer carrying narcotics is going to go through the port of entry where they have dogs and sensors?
Well, Steve, I'm going to thank you for your call there. But once again, DHS, Customs and Border Protection, say that the majority of the drugs coming, the heroin coming in through the southern border is coming in through ports of entry on things like tractor trailers. But Steve, thank you for your call here. Julian Zelizer, we've got about a minute here left to go before I want to switch gears and talk about a different topic with a different guest. But just your final thought on where we find ourselves today vis-a-vis the presidency and this moment in history.
I think we're going to see even more of an effort in the next few months on many levels, from emergency power to his response to the Russia investigation, of President Trump really flexing presidential power in a way that's going to put Republicans in the Senate on the spot. We're going to see how far Senate Republicans are willing to go in allowing the president to do all the various things that he's doing that don't have majority opinion, that are not based in the facts, and that many people feel in the long term are going to be destructive to the GOP. And I hear Senator Murkowski and her comments, the voice of conscience, but I really think Senator Graham right now is in many ways the face of the Republican Party. So I think we're going to see where's the Republican Party setting itself up as it thinks about 2020 and the decision that voters are going to have to make about who the next leader of the country should be.
Well, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and author of Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974, just out yesterday. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico. It's always great to have you, Eliana. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
All right. Well, in the last couple of minutes of the show here today, we want to switch gears to another story that actually kind of got buried in all the talk about the wall yesterday. This has to do with President Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, and an improperly redacted court filing made by his lawyers. So joining us from Washington is Paula Reed, CBS News correspondent covering the Justice Department, the White House, and legal affairs. Paula, it's great to have you.
Thanks so much.
Okay, so there was this bit of reporting that came out yesterday that Paul Manafort's lawyers submitted a court filing that was improperly redacted, and it revealed some interesting things about what the Mueller investigation is alleging about Manafort. What have we discovered?
That's right. This is a cut-and-paste error. This was something that they wanted to be redacted, but instead we could all see clearly that lawyers for former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort revealed that the special counsel has evidence that Manafort shared polling data with an associate tied to Russian intelligence during the 2016 campaign. And as you noted, it's amazing that this was buried, speak to what kind of news day it was yesterday, because this is the first time that prosecutors have accused the former Trump campaign chief of sharing information about the election with a Russian associate. Of course, this goes to sort of the core of the special counsel probe.
Wow. Okay. So was this polling data public, private? I mean, and does that even matter?
What matters, we don't know too much about specifically what information was shared, just the fact that it was, and this has been the big question. Was there any cooperation, coordination, people use the word collusion, between Russians and the campaign? The president has denied it. The question is, what was the purpose of this data? What was it used for? If it was used in any way to meddle in the election or to help the Trump campaign, that could potentially be evidence of a conspiracy or a violation of campaign finance law, especially if Paul Manafort knew what it was going to be used for.
Now, tell us more about this Russian associate of Paul Manafort's. It's Konstantin Kilimnik, right?
Exactly. Konstantin Kilimnik, he is believed to be a Russian intelligence contact, and he worked closely with Manafort for years promoting Russian-backed Ukrainian interests. And the filings also reveal that Manafort may have discussed a Ukraine peace deal on behalf of the campaign with Kilimnik on more than one occasion. So here you just have more evidence of contacts between a Trump campaign official and someone with ties to Russian intelligence. There are no charges related to that. There's no indication that Robert Mueller views this as a criminal activity. But this is exactly the kind of stuff that we expect will be in the final report. These tidbits, these details that don't really rise to the level of overt charges, but draw a larger picture about what kind of contacts were occurring between the Trump campaign and Russia.
Right. And so is the timing here critical? Because I'm seeing reports that Manafort is alleged to have transferred this information to Kilimnik in the spring of 2016, around the time that that then-candidate Trump was close to clinching the nomination.
It could be. And, of course, that's around the time June 2016 is when the infamous Trump Tower meeting occurred with Jared Kushner, Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, and a lawyer offering dirt on Secretary Clinton. So the timing is significant. That's certainly something the special counsel is looking at.
Okay. But there's nothing in the filing that says that Manafort was or if Mueller knows if Manafort was acting at the campaign's behest, though, is there?
Well, I mean, is the campaign chairman ever not acting, you know, in his official role? I mean, what's interesting is a lot of people say, look, this had nothing to do with Trump. But some of even Paul Manafort's tax fraud, bank fraud, other things that he's already been convicted on, some of that behavior did occur while he was the Trump campaign chairman. So, yes, it was not directed by the Trump campaign. But you have to remember, when you're representing a campaign in that capacity, you would think you would be especially careful of running afoul of the law.
Paula, is this big?
It is incredibly significant because, again, this is the president has consistently denied there were any contacts between his campaign and Russia. And here you have his campaign chairman, who has already been convicted of lying to banks and the government. There's evidence that he was sharing something with someone who has known ties to Russian intelligence. So it is so far, it's the clearest evidence thus far of any kind of cooperation between the campaign and Russia. It raises a lot of questions. But again, this finally indicates they do not expect to charge Paul Manafort with any more charges.
Wow. Okay. Well, we'll see what the Mueller team may do with this information, though. Paula, we've got about 30 seconds here left to go. Since I have you and you're a woman in the Justice Department, tell us a little bit more about what you're hearing about Rod Rosenstein saying that he will leave the DOJ after the new attorney general, if and when that person he's confirmed.
That's right. He's expected to leave in the next few weeks after William Barr is expected to be confirmed. We're told that he just saw this as a 2-year position, and he wants to stay on for a short time during the transition. But we have to apply some skepticism to this. The number two job at Justice, they run the day-to-day operations. This would leave the special counsel investigation possibly under Barr's oversight. He's been publicly very critical, and it's not really clear why Barr would want to start such a tough job without a confirmed number two. That would leave him with a lot of additional administrative work. The White House denies they're pushing Rosenstein out. We're asking a lot of questions over the next few days about this.
Well, Paula Reed, CBS News correspondent covering the Justice Department, the White House, and legal affairs. Paula, it is always great to have you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And we'll put links up to the reporting around these Paul Manafort filings. Go to onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.